Hey everyone, welcome to Energy Advocacy Media. You're watching the Journey Series video podcast. I'm Mark, a brown man with black and white beard. I'm bald. Today I'm wearing a maroon shirt. I'm in front of a brown background.
And I'm Crystal. I'm Mark's co-host, and I have on a gray and teal with white stripes shirt, and I'm in I don't know, I have a white wall with a brown partial background and a shelf picture.
And today we have a special guest joining us. She's going to tell us a bit about her journey and her daughter's journey. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm Nicole Smith, and I am a woman that has light skin and dark hair. I am in a room that has is a older home that has blue walls and blue trim. Yeah.
Go ahead and tell us a bit about your background and your journey so far.
Yeah, so I actually grew up in Ohio. I live in Nashville, Tennessee now. I am a happily married woman to a beautiful man that we've been married for almost 14 years. It's pretty wild. And we've got two little girls. I've got an 8-year-old little girl that really was just a deeply empowering journey to motherhood. Obviously, Mark, you don't understand that, but motherhood is an incredibly empowering moment. You know, I, eight years ago and some change, gave birth to a beautiful little girl, 29-hour labor, totally unmedicated, 15 minutes of pushing, broke almost every blood vessel in my face to bring life into the world. And I was just like, wow, this is so incredible that someone could do this, you know. So that was a really big, impactful moment in my journey as just a human person. And we were so excited about that, that about a year later, we decided we wanted to bring another life into the world. And that sort of shifted my journey into something that was a little bit different than I really had anticipated. I started to experience a physical ailment that created a scenario in which I was in an immeasurable pain every day, where no doctor really could provide any solution to it. And one of the byproducts of that was secondary infertility. So I was unable to conceive a child. As I was sort of journeying through this health, like awareness of what was going on and trying to find solutions, my predicament was starting to improve mildly, but then it started to make me experience miscarriages. So there's an incredibly challenging period in our life where I don't know if you guys have experienced infertility or anything like that, or if you've, you know, tried to have children. There's so much desire. All your hopes and dreams are really wrapped up into your ability to conceive a child, grow a child, deliver that child, and lots of pain and anguish that came where I lost a lot of joy with my oldest daughter. So it was in seeking out this new life, you know. So when I finally did conceive my second little daughter, there was an immense amount of joy, but also a lot of anxiety around that. And for what would be a relatively natural and, you know, relatively carefree pregnancy would end in something that was totally unrelated to that ailment. I basically experienced an accident, the best way of looking at it. So this is like 3.5 years ago. My precious little one was this height of COVID kind of deal, right? So yeah, it was a 27-hour labor. So I think I went into labor before that quite a bit, you know. So we sort of were spun into an event where, you know, I go into labor like 3 weeks early. I wasn't able to get all of my testing done because of COVID regulations. Yeah. So 27-hour labor, I wasn't touched because they were afraid of introducing an infection, that those last tests would really reveal. So it turned out I had what they call a prolapse cord. It's when the umbilical cord comes out in advance of the baby and basically suffocates the baby to death slowly. Like low oxygen flow obviously means ischemic brain damage. And so I'm laboring for all this time. They finally decide to touch me, realize I have a prolapse cord, rushed into the OR. I don't have an epidural. I'm put under general anesthesia. Pretty wild stuff. Like, just like, everything's fine, then everything's not fine. rushed in the OR. They rip me open within like 10 minutes and pull her out. But my husband wasn't able to be there because she's suffocating to death. I'm not consciously there because I'm put under general. So when we wake up, they never tell me that she actually was resuscitated. They never told me there were any complications whatsoever. But it became very clear very soon. Like, she was unable to latch and suck, like, so she's unable to feed herself. And it was like 4 days of back and forth. Like, you can go home. No, you can't. You can go home. No, you can't. Okay. Like, what is happening? And of course, like, again, this is COVID. So like, no family's there. You know, my oldest daughter can't be there. My husband, by the grace of God only, was allowed to be there for a very short period of time. That was the recovery. And so, you know, this whole process of not really know what was wrong, they finally, you know, say, hey, we're going to move you into NICU. So it was this long walk from the children's hospital to the adult hospital, in which they kicked my husband out and said, now you're on your own, Nicole. And if you've ever been in the NICU experience, it's very traumatic. I had just been ripped open, remember? And when you have an epidural, don't have an epidural and get under general anesthesia, you're just chasing the pain. You know, none of the pain medication actually works. And one of my daughter's symptoms was hyperlethargy. She was hardly ever able to wake up. So I was afraid that when we did give her my milk, that there would be narcotics in the breast milk and would exacerbate the hyperlethargy. And so I decided to go cold turkey off of it as well. So imagine sitting in NICU, totally alone. They give you one little chair in the corner to sit. And then at night, they put you into a raffle to allow you to have a bed for the night in a totally different room from your child. And so I would go in at night and my body would go into shock. Like, I would shake for hours and hours on end in pain. And then I got up in the morning and I'd get dressed and put my makeup on and put my stuff in a locker and go sit back in that little corner again. And just to watch my daughter go through a series of very, very intense testing process. And we would be there for about a month. So there's a lot of confusion. They didn't really want to. Actually, the way I found out she was resuscitated was when the nurses change shifts, right? So they talk to each other and they give the medical history. And I overhear one of the nurses saying resuscitation of newborn infant, basically. Like, I was like, what?
What?
What? And because like, they're doing all these tests, like, you know, tests for, you know, if there's an infection and there's a genetic stuff and all this stuff. And I'm like, if she was resuscitated, like, it seems like this would be a pretty clear case, right? You know? Well, then I got it reaffirmed a couple of days later with the insurance for $746 resuscitation of newborn infant. I'm like, okay, so here we are, essentially, access to quality care was part of the problem, how we got here. And coming to terms with that as a parent has been a struggle over the years. You can't go back, you can't change, right? You know, you can only go forward. So really what it became is a very fast-tracked lesson on her condition, you know. So obviously when she's really young, they didn't fully diagnose her until she was 6 months old. She got the formal diagnosis of cerebral palsy. And so her current state, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happened in between that was difficult. You know, she stopped breathing a lot. That was kind of her thing. I say, like, I can't count how many times in a day she just didn't I turn around, she'd be totally purple, you know, lifeless type thing. That happened for a long time. She was fed with a G tube for a long time as well, because she's unable to get, even she aspirated on her own spit. It was so bad. And, you know, as she grew, you know, other challenges present themselves, you know, through development. Like, they're not meeting any other milestones. And you get this awareness as a parent too, like, you know, you other parents are like, "Ooh, my baby's sitting up." You're like, "Yay, you know, great." Well, you don't realize there's like 100 developmental milestones in between those events, right? And so, I had to go through this like psychological awareness of finding joy in those baby steps and like knowing that she's just doing her best, and it's okay for her to just be her and not to be compared to those outward ideas, you know, of like what success is in our children. Mm-hmm. And so fast forward to today, you know, we can talk about some of the realities that sort of unfolded it with that accident, but, you know, she's nonverbal. And she walks with a walker, and she is light wherever she goes. Like, she's joy. And I can't imagine a world where she would not be in it, you know? So I'm incredibly grateful to those doctors that did resuscitate her. Boy, would I have liked to have known and ahead of time. But I find a deep sense of purpose in just getting to be called her mommy. So,
that's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. And we talked a minute ago about the importance of integrating disability students or just people in general with people that don't have a disability and the kind of things they can teach people.
Oh, yeah.
Able-bodied and, you know, or non-disabled rather.
Yeah.
And then the people that are disabled, you know, they can learn from the one that's not disabled. And then, they, of course, they have different lessons and different experiences in life. And so they can learn from each other. But the world has just been taught that that's ugly. And it's
and undesirable.
Different. Yeah. And let's shun away everything that's gross or looks different.
So I think I've always had this kind of life saying that expectations are the death of joy. And this is really true, even with reasonable expectations. Like, you know, it was very reasonable to expect that I could conceive a second child if I've had one, you know, very reasonable. There's a lot of disappointment and grief that comes in that, right? It was very reasonable to believe that, you know, if I give birth to a child, that she have a normal trajectory, very reasonable expectation. But it deprives you of a sense of joy right where you are. Because when our children don't meet our expectations, or people in general, like, or life in general, don't meet our expectations, especially I believe in the Western world, we have a tendency to want to dispense of those things. And so much so that you're dispensing a whole group of people because they didn't meet your expectation of what value is.
Right. Or that they need to be saved, or they need to be
pitied. Or pity.
Yes. So they're discarded because of that situation, and everybody follows suit to that, you know, especially coming first from the parents. and their professionals that tell parents, yeah, this is what is going on in this song, you need to just read it. So if we start by, if doctors and professionals could understand it better and stop using those that terminology, then I think it would be a trickle down thing of more accepting disability and things we about.
Well, and I think for, obviously I don't speak for someone that has walked this path because I haven't personally. I'm just have the honor of holding the hand of somebody else that's walking this path, right? But I can speak to that parent experience, right? That you are mourning those lost, unmet expectations, right? And then that's a journey. It's a life journey. You're not always, you're going to try to compare it, and that you're mourning that comparison, right? And it's allow yourself to go through that process of grief, all the seven stages, right? Because the sooner you allow yourself to process that grief, the sooner you can find that joy on the other side of it. That in grief, there's like a numbness, right? You'll only focus so much on that the trauma experience that you're not seeing those things on the peripheral, like, because you're so focused, right? And I've watched myself go through that process of allowing myself to have these moments of immersion into that deep grief, because it's not just unmet expectations. It's also that my baby is hurt, and I don't want to see her struggle in very basic ways, but going through that, I've seen so foundationally her value as a person is not that she meet my expectation, not that she meets society's expectation, but just that she is a creature made by God himself and important just the way she is, regardless of the circumstances in which she was born. And once you have that realization as a parent, man, it's very freeing. And honestly, it applies to your other children if you have that are like gone by the typical pathways, right? That they aren't going to meet your expectations. In fact, that's not really their purpose in life, is to meet your expectations, and then that's not where you find drive your joy, right? And so, I would definitely say my oldest daughter is incredibly advantaged to have a sister that has walked a different path. Like, she's in third grade, and they actually are doing a service project, which is really sweet. And so the service project, they have to come up with a concept for a mission and a name and a logo, like the whole thing. Like, they're building an organization. And I asked her what she wanted to do, and she said she wanted to teach sign language. And the reasons why you need sign language is not always because you're a deaf person, that there's other reasons why you might need access to that form of expression, right? And she brings her into school, and she's just so darn proud. Like, all the children like gather around, and she's like, my little 3-year-old's like, yeah, like, everybody's so excited I'm here. And she just, like I said, joy wherever she goes, and she brings smiles to people's faces. And to think that if she wasn't here and she wasn't meeting expectations, she wouldn't have that, we wouldn't have this clarity that we have through her. So,
I think something important both of you said there, and if we can just kind of tie it together and sort of so Crystal is a big fan of psychology, and I like to that I'm more into philosophy, but it's interesting how they both sort of, I mean, at some level they both you can't ignore one at the expense of another or whatever. But we're talking about conforming to society and society's perceptions and all that. And we go into these different roles of whether it be teacher or parent or podcast host with expectations about who, about with labels that we have already stuck in our head, like students are there to learn from me because I'm all the all-wise and the all-knowing teacher, right?
Yeah.
Or the all-wise and the all-knowing parent. And I think that's something sort of backwards about our society. Like Eastern philosophy is, you know, and definitely parents and teachers who are more aware are more keen to adopt the philosophy that I'm actually learning from them.
Yeah.
So who's really the teacher?
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a distortion, you know, I'll get into like more of the work that I do actually in the human dignity space, that I think what you guys are saying is so true. It's a culture that's actually creating these disparities in value, because we have this idea that us as human beings, our values derived from what we contribute to society, not just that we are human. And that may seem like a very slight different approach in how you see the world, but it's actually a very major
difference. Very relatable. Yeah. Very.
It's massive.
It's very top down. Like I'm the parent, they're the child, they're below me.
Yeah.
Or I'm a teacher, they're student, they're down there, I'm up here.
Yeah.
Or they're a woman, I'm a man, I'm up here, and all this other stuff.
Well, and it's a pursuit of our sense of purpose, right? So like any of this hierarchical structure that we're talking about is an inward glimpse. The person on top is, that's an inward glimpse on the way they feel about themselves. They're trying to assume a sense of purpose and power and superiority because they feel inferior. And again, like you can only assert authority over someone that you feel as if you can categorize as lesser. And you can categorize them lesser if you're looking at them as something other than just, hey, they're a person. They're a human person. Do they have a human DNA? Check. Then we're equal. And equal meaning equal value meaning equal importance. Because even that word equality is very, very distorted in our culture. That word is used to say we're unequal means this, right? Mm-hmm. Equal is like same. No. Equal is not same. equal is an importance. We have equal value, therefore we're equal importance, but we're not the same, and that's okay. And in fact, we're not meant to be the same, you know?
Right.
Like, how awful would it be if we all came out the other end and were exactly the same? Like, there's just a robotic reality. And then that makes it easy to discount people that don't fit into that category of what we perceive in culture as valuable, which the disability community right. very easily can fit into because they don't meet expectations, you know?
Right.
And they should want to be like us, or we're surprised when they find joy. And you're like, why are you surprised? Like, they're not meeting your expectations because you're ignorant in your experiences, but maybe one day you won't be ignorant, right? Maybe you will get into an accident and your life changes. And then you realize, oh gosh, like value, it isn't derived from the way I contribute to society. You know, it's interesting.
I think if everybody had the ability to look inside themselves and realize what their purpose is, instead of going from the derived thing that was put in place by hundreds of years ago, mm-hmm. you know, and that's like you mentioned, hierarchy, you know, and what's meant to be perceived as somebody that's got whatever title, you know, instead of looking at somebody and how they understand the world and can make it better for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be a much better place.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Mark.
Without making it too political, that's how we get like people in power, like presidents. because people are just looking, oh, do they look like a president? I think a president should look, instead of automatically disqualifying people because they don't look or act a certain way or don't have certain, are able-bodied maybe, but maybe they're superiorly qualified to hold that position, but we're just going to disqualify them because they don't fit our stereotype of what they should be.
Yeah, and I think it's, and it does come back to experience and awareness, right? So we gravitate towards something that is familiar, right? Because if it's familiar, we understand it, we experience it. But until you haven't, I always say, like, truth spoken and empathy is far more impactful than truth spoken and sympathy. You have to experience something in order to know the truth. And when you experience those things, you know the truth of what that group really encapsulates. And so you have all the world looking in, having no idea how to empathize because they've never experienced it. It's not familiar. And so they gravitate towards these ideals, like you were saying, of those that seem presidential or seem like they fit these certain qualifications that are most valuable in those spaces. And then you realize really when people have gone through these really hard realities, you have character refinement that those who don't go through those, I could never even imagine being built in them. You know, it's like crazy.
One question, maybe for the new parents out there who have a child with a disability, could you unpack, or is there a handy checklist you have for how to find a suitable school?
Oh gosh, yeah. So I would say overall, like, you know, your children are going to grow with time, right? So you're going to grow with them. Be patient in the stage of life you are right now, but have a wherewithal to look forward a few steps, or at least try to anticipate it. And you know, everybody has to sort of navigate the reality and the space of the world they're in, right? So I'm in Tennessee, you know, our laws are different, our benefits are different, resources are different, right? So, you
Yes.
know, sort of try to go into your community and kind of see what those resources are. You know, if you have government resources that you can contact and say, like, hey, you know, this is what's going on. Can you tell me what it is that we can have access to? And then once you start to apply to these benefits or whatever you get your hands on, like start seeing, okay, my child has this problem or need, organizations will fill this need, right? And just start going out and pursuing them and then being as creative as you can with those resources. Because I think a lot of times as parents too, like we're so lost in this process, we're so overwhelmed that we forget that we are our child's greatest advocate, and we will only be the greatest advocate they ever will have. We can't rely on those that are providing the services to tell us what those needs are, because I made a lot of mis like I feel like there were mistakes. I regret some of the stuff I did with my daughter early on because I was so overwhelmed that I relied on the experts, right? And we dealt with the ramifications for months and months and months after that, some of those decisions where, you know, again, give yourself patience and grace, but, you know, look at the moment, look at a little few steps ahead, go out and ask what resources are out there and start pursuing them right where you are. Because just an example for ours, our community does not have many options for young children. Like in the disability space, like our state doesn't provide respite for young children. They will provide for adult children, respite for adult children. So like there's just not a lot of services for young children. So I was trying to pursue like private schools, right? And try to use a grant that I got to pay for those. But for the greater Nashville area, there are only three schools that will provide care to children in that age group. Yeah, it's pretty wild. And there's a lot of people in Nashville, just FYI. And there's a very robust disability community here as well. So you can get on a list for very many, many years and you will never get in. So I was like, okay, brick wall, let's like navigate and try to figure out the ways around. So, you know, like I had to, we ended up getting her in a preschool that was through the public school system. And because she's nonverbal, she speaks ASL or is learning ASL. I got to choose a school. Like, so don't just like go to like what you're districted for. Like, look at the ask. What are the best schools for like your kids' specific needs? And most of the time they'll actually place you in those, you know, because you actually legally in the United States, at least, they have to actually place you where your child's needs can be met most, especially in the, like, if they qualify in your district. So like, that's what I did. I'm not, that school's not, she's not zoned for that school. And I was like, I'm picking that school. And they're like, okay. They didn't argue. They just placed her there. So yeah, it's been good. She's only been in school for a few weeks, but she's found great joy in building friendships and community with, it's been really a blessing. So to see her flourish.
We were talking also before about just the opportunities it's given her. She's opened up a lot more, and she's excited about interacting with other people that have the same needs and the same physical aspects that she needs to thrive.
Yeah. And it's wild to watch like a community sort of build up around your child that you just like never thought and imagined you possibly could, you know? And I'm sure that this will develop and evolve with time, because she's not going to be just with the same team. You know, she hasn't been with the same team the whole time she's been born. You know, we had therapists from in NICU with her. So we've definitely been on a path, but to build that community of just like people that just genuinely care about the outcome for your child. And it's been good to feel not alone, right?
Yeah. And, you know, talking about the child experience is very different from the adult experience. And that's a lot of what we want to do with our platform is, you know, highlight the opportunities that kids have with the disability, but as soon as they age out of school, then what those opportunities and those, like you mentioned, the wait list, they exponentially, you know, are almost impossible to meet the requirements. And even when you do meet the requirements, still they ask for so much personal information, and so much red tape is put in place make those things almost impossible to
access. Achieve. Yeah, I know. I remember trying to get an adaptive bike for her. Like, our therapist said, you know, and there's this nonprofit that does adaptive bikes. You can get them for free. And I was like, I think like a 3-year wait list or something like that, because they're just overwhelmed. You know, these organizations are really overwhelmed, not enough resources to like meet all the demand. And yeah, like we've encountered a lot of those like scenarios, but yeah, you're right. And I'd also like advise parents too. And we talked about this before, like just, you know, behind the scenes about the system needing to be like person-centric instead of program-centric. And if we did that for all of society, not just the disability community, I think it would enrich us. Because I actually have a background where I was in special education as a child because I had learning disabilities. And, you know, I ended up going on and getting a master's in law and public policy. So like, it worked out well. I had parents that were really, really, really supportive. and strived to give me what I specifically needed it. But it took an individual after countless tutors to realize that I was a unique person. Oh, surprise, surprise. Like, my brain doesn't work very linear. She understood two things. I was a very creative person. And also that I had been beaten down so much to made to feel stupid and incapable that I stopped trying, right? And she took these two things, awareness of my individuality and confidence, and said, okay, what do we do with that? And so from going from literally like I was 12, 13 years old, not able to read at all, going to almost a 12th grade reading level overnight, just this awareness.
Wow.
It was wild. And then of course I still struggled all the way through my master's and even into my career with words. We have like a very personal battle. But that experience for me, like personally, made me realize, like, if we were just to be centric towards the individual and realize, like, not everybody's the same way. And the disability community understands it most because everybody's needs are so unique. And being willing to stand up and say, okay, what does my child need? And going to the places in which they need it, and like really fighting through that process to ensure that to the best of your ability, you can find those unique solutions. Like we've been bringing my daughter to Iowa of all places for a really unique therapy experience that it's almost like up and coming. And we've found some like benefits that help us provide for that extra, but you know, willing to get up and do something as unique as you possibly can to meet those needs. So.
It is so important to us to share these stories as well, because we want people to come to the realization that not just because it makes sense on a common sense level, but also economically, to include and have, you know, as simple as access to be able to get places. Why not make the infrastructure where everybody can be included in things? And sure, if they can get in the building, but not to the table, to, you know, then it's crazy. Yeah. But I mean, why wouldn't we want to build a world now, because these kids are getting older, our parents are getting older.
Yeah.
And it's not going to make economic sense if we don't do these things now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I know it's a struggle. I mean, obviously my daughter is small enough. We can pick her up and carry her, not to the detriment of my back, just FYI, she's so heavy. But we went to a beach last week and she's in a walker. She can't walk on the sand. It's reality. And we went crab hunting in the middle of the night. Like, this is on the Gulf Shore, and there's like hundreds of these crabs. Like, it's kind of creepy, but also really cool. So I have nieces and my other daughter, you know, they're just running around. So, you know, Cosette, my daughter that has CP, we were giving her a net so she could like try to like scoop it, but we were helping her, you know, as we carried her, right? So finally she was like, she's trying to get down. And she's like crawling through the sand and chasing these crabs and like grabbing them. We're so proud of her. She's like, I don't want this stupid net and your pity help. Okay. Like, I can do this myself. And just willing, like that awareness, like, this is really hard for her. And it's really hard for parents to like give your children these experiences. But just, it's hard, but it's so worth it. Like, just striving to make these moments and experiences accessible, because, you know, Cosette sees that her cousins and her sister can do these things, right? And she knows in her mind's eye, her awareness is like, hey, I'm not able to do these things. Well, no, you can do it. Not, it may not look like her. We're going to make it happen, you know? Yeah.
But also, I would tell her also, you know, you can do things and you have a mind and experience, you experience things that they will never
will ever
know.
experience. Yes. Well, and
Yeah.
too, like telling her as well is like, you know, we do like subconsciously as humans, just like she's the only person in her reality that doesn't have wheels, like that has wheels, you know. So yeah, like she gets to experience these things that other kids don't, and to find pride and not a limitation in that. It's again, it's something we battle as humans, but also as parents. Like I'll say this, like I've known enough people in the CP community now that are adults and have gone through this. And one of the things that they always say about their parents is to let them have that freedom to experience, because they're so afraid of what they can't do instead of seeing what they can. And how you learn and develop is by giving them those experiences, because they need to adapt in their own ways. So I took that to heart as a parent. And I'm kind of one of those parents anyway. I did that with my older kid. Like, you just got to go for it, right? But just an awareness of like sometimes at certain environments, there's going to be some limitations that you kind of have to find some solutions for ahead of time. Like, hey, maybe it is a net and she gets to scurry through the sand like a crab herself and have that experience. So.
And then also having a disability and a parent that is too cautious and protective
And
of
afraid.
everything, it sets them up as an adult for not knowing how to figure it
Adapt.
out, not
Yeah.
knowing how to, they don't have the mentality or the skills or the muscle memory
Yeah.
to do things because
Well,
they're saving them, you know.
it's exactly true. And I honestly, I think there's a generation of that anyway, like the hover parents, like even like standard kids were like, there's no common sense. These poor kids, like their parents did it all for them. It's very clear, you know. So sorry, Mark, what were you gonna say?
Or it's a case of maybe they do have the skills or at least the ability to, but they're overly cautious because they were taught to be overly cautious and anxious about these things. And so they don't even try because they're just paralyzed with fear.
Well, and I do think that's a part condition. Sometimes it's nature. Like my oldest daughter is like so cautious, and we've always taught her like climb the tree, fall down, like please, like your brain needs to receive that input in order for it to learn how to avoid that input, right? So if you want to avoid getting injured, you have to be put in a situation in which risk is acquired so that they can learn how to overcome that risk. Which is so funny, like Cosette, my youngest, is not afraid at all. Like she just like is a dive in kind of gal, which I appreciated about her because given her situation, she kind of needed that kind of tenacity, right? It's like, but I think that's part of her condition of like who she is as a person. That was just a blessing that was bestowed upon her, you know, just by being a per her, you know, right? So.
And ask people who love psychology or it's important to emphasize we're not pointing fingers here. Like I alluded to before, you know, it has to do with the trickle down of, you know, from the beginning, people are taught to do this and that from the professional side, you know. And as new parents, what are you gonna do? You've never experienced, you
Any of
know,
this,
having
yeah.
if you don't have one child before that, don't know, you're totally at the, you know,
Oh yeah.
you know,
No, I get.
where else are you gonna look to, you know, and take advice from?
Yeah, and not everybody in the system is helpful and wants the success of your children. Like the medical system, like I think we kind of talked a little bit about that too. They're so fearful of the liability that your child poses, more so they see a dollar sign, they don't see a soul, right? And we had to wade through that medical, like that awareness of the medical world very early on, where I knew that these people probably meant well, they wanted to, but they were unable to because the system would prevent them from caring. Because if anything went wrong, they're afraid of being sued. And I know the circumstance in which she was born, it was an accident. We've come to terms with that as well. Like we did pursue just looking into the legal aspects of it, but my husband and I felt very, very, very strongly that any of those sorts of events in the medical world that you would pursue legal action against are intended to not just like give you money. It's supposed to change an outcome for other people in the same situation, right? And so we felt very strongly it was very tied to COVID restrictions, and that the scenario in which we kind of played out was because of those restrictions. And we don't want to look at that. Society just doesn't want to admit that there were other casualties. So there was a lot of legal walls put up shortly after she was born to prevent any claim against COVID. Again, it was liability. It was very sad. So we look at it, God's provision is for her, and we'll just keep plugging away at this and be the best for her we possibly can, despite the circumstance that we were dulled in that moment. So
a lot of these, the system is kind of built, and the whole thing is the way the medical system is educated. It's all funded by certain people who are pulling the strings that are dictating laws and ways of that they should act, so that money ends up in their pockets,
basically. And not, yeah. Well, and I think even in the West too, like our approach to health, like the health of our body, the health of our mind, the health of our soul, the health, you know, like all the aspects of who we are, it's wrong. Like how we approach these things are dictated by those people that profit. And instead of saying no more and changing our mindset about how we approach our health and wellness and where our value is derived from, I think that's when we start cutting the strings from these people that are making money off of us.
It's not going to be an easy process to get people away from that structure that was built and the things that they are told should be in place that are actually very harmful.
Yes.
Everybody involved.
Yeah. And it's like you said, it's money. A lot of the medicines that we sort of pursue on, and I know in the disability community, like a lot of the medicines really, really help in the moment to stop a lot of symptoms. But the more I've researched and the more research is coming out, especially, you know, I know about cerebral palsy. Like I research it a lot because, you know, obviously it's my everyday, right? So like more things are coming out that are fringe, and you see like the medical community like freaking out because they don't want, they want to like push it off as it's like a hack job, right? Like this is just hack, like terrible people. They're stupid. They don't know what to talk about. And then you start seeing the results. Like one of the therapies we were doing, it's like considered off on the fringe, right? And it's not at all, but it's not what they know, and it's not what they make their money on, and it's not what like their normal process was. And I remember this like shift in my mind. I'm like, you know what? I'm not just blind following what they're telling me, because like you have to, like what Mark was saying, you have to follow the dollar signs that are beyond it. Maybe even that physician doesn't realize it, but that system is made to protect that system and not your child, not to make them better. It's meant to make them money. And so like some of those like prescriptions they were putting them on, I'm like, this doesn't solve anything for her. It just gives her symptoms. And so what else is out there? Like just started digging and finding there's a lot of therapies out there. A lot of like, I mean, they're in the supplement areas, but you know, like genuinely change outcomes over time for her. And I mean, it's like I highly encourage parents to do your diligence and see what's out there for your kid's condition, that it
Right.
doesn't just keep you in that cycle of like dependence, right?
Your gut.
So,
And
go ahead.
we've also got to look deeper. I mean, it's not too long ago, like 50 years ago, doctors were telling people, smoking is good for you, or there's no scientific evidence that prayer or meditation is beneficial, right? But fast forward to now, and like everyone, like no one questions it. Like, so you got to wonder all this fringe stuff that's coming out that they're recoiling against. Is it really because that's not the right thing to do?
Well, and I say, look at results, man. Like some of the stuff that I had done is like, because I was looking at real life case studies of individuals that look just like my daughter. And they're going through these therapeutic processes in which they have outcomes that I desire for my own daughter. Like, why on earth would you? And it's not like snake oil kind of stuff where they're putting it on display. It's like legit stuff with they're backed with research. And, they're recoiling. I think I had one physician who's like, where is their scientific curiosity in all this? Like they
Again, let's just follow the money.
And it's like so I don't even some of my physician, I don't even tell what we do. Like I was like, I'll come back and report on victories, and they're like, oh, it's great. She's like doing great things. And I'm like,
Oh, yeah, no, sorry.
I won't tell you what we did. I'm like, I'm just gonna say it was like the miracle of God. Now, there's a lot of miracles of God in her, but there was a lot of like outward things. I wasn't willing to settle for what they were giving me anymore. So
No, a lot of it is listening to your eternal self and what you believe in, and then trust again, trusting your gut going with that.
And suddenly, I'd say to you, I guess I'm like trying to encourage parents, like settling into it as a journey. Like, there's no miracle event that will ever change your circumstance, like for your child, right? Whether it's a miracle drug or a miracle therapy, like, it doesn't matter what it is. You're not going to change the outcome for your child overnight. Just settle into that journey of where they are right now. Allow the season with them to be a source of joy. So like I believe that from the moment of conception to like death at a ripe old age, that each season in our life has a blessing and a curse. And typically our inclination is to gravitate towards that negative aspect, the curse, right? But it becomes devoid of that joy. Like we don't see the joys that are in it. So, fight fiercely for your child, but like lean into your baby, like lean into your child right where they are, because they have breath in their lungs. They have breath in their lungs. Like I had friends force educated on the travesty and the devastation that is death of a child. And when we were in NICU, I would like walk around NICU and pray over those children because I just walked through with friends that they buried their baby. And I pray over those children so that their parents would see it, their value right where they were. And to feel seen too, right? Because it's really hard to walk that out. I've walked it out. I would not want to go back and repeat a single moment of it, but I would want to go back and preserve those beautiful moments that she has breath, right? So, yeah, she's alive.
I know that had to have been really hard, but you've been doing amazing with loving her for who she is and seeing the value in her life and making it fit yours instead of her fitting, you know what I'm saying? Making it work instead of trying to make her conform to what essentially.
Well, and I think too, it's like it's easy, like I said, we were talking about before about dispensing of that value because it's going to be hard. Like, I know there was laws being presented that would allow for death by medical neglect up to 28 days after birth. And so essentially that I could have been advised by the doctors to just not resuscitate her because her quality of life wouldn't meet standards, right? And it would just be more merciful to let her die. And absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I can't, that's another thing to unpack. I mean, obviously we don't want people to suffer too much where they can't, you know, but what does standards even mean? I mean, whose standards? Who made those up?
Well, and it's easier to let them die for the system. Like, I think it's more of a declaration of the ease for the system than it is for the individual that's going walking that out, right? So now they're just a burden. Like, we have to pay money for them. That's like, and so it's easy to sell it as, well, you just let them die because they're not going to have a quality of life. And here you have a whole community, like cerebral palsy is the largest disability community in the world. And they're saying, I'm worked. What are you talking about? Like, I've had a wonderful life. Like, you know, I have my challenges, you know, I wish that the world would see me with greater value and that they would try to meet my needs more, but that's what we're working towards, right? Because they do have intrinsic value. They are worth showing up for. They are worth resuscitating and resuscitating every time they stop breathing. You know, I just, you know, and so, you know, from a parent's perspective, obviously that's mine, but, you know, just hearing that from other people in the disability community and knowing that the medical field actively tells parents to abort their children or to just, you know, let them die on the table. That's not the whole picture. It, you know, I'm just advocating for, there's a bigger picture here. Right. So,
right. And I would like to go back some where we're talking about, you know, that internal using that instead of always thinking that medicine is your only option. Certainly there are situations and circumstances where certainly that's the only route.
Yeah, absolutely.
Necessary. But I think it's coupled with knowing when you can internally use that situation primarily and putting that medicine in there when it's needed.
Yeah, and I've seen too, like, the making an idol out of medicine. I had a friend, she had a diagnosis in utero and that her son was not going to survive. And so she carried the pregnancy to term and, you know, he passed away. And she's talked about the psychological experience she had from the diagnosis to the birth, that she just believed that science was going to, like, pull through, right? And science and medicine doesn't always pull through, right? You know, sometimes life is just so hard in the sense that we don't have the answer, but we still should fight for working to make that life as good as we possibly can right where it is, right? And if we don't maintain that at all stages in our development, then we sort of, that's where we throw it away when life gets tough. Like, what the disability community experiences every day is, like, society is like, hey, that's too hard. No, it is hard, but you're so freaking worth it. Like, I'm going to show up and tell you you're important and loved. And I'm going to work really, really hard to make sure that you have what you need because you're important and you're worth fighting for. And I'm so glad you have breath in your lungs, you know. So. Yeah.
And to tie that idea into what we were talking about previously about some doctor or whoever making a determination that this child isn't going to have a quality of life. I mean, I guess it's down to you as a parent assessing who you are and who's around you to say, no, we're committed to giving the child a quality of life. We don't need you to tell us what that looks like.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's just by the necessity of that statement, right? Like, they feel it's necessary to make a statement is a devaluation of those who are literally walking that through in their life. Like, how dare anybody have the audacity to say that and place it upon somebody else's eardrum. Like, you never, I never want my daughter to hear that. Like that her life and the fight that she went through is not worth living. She wasn't worth the fight or the getting up every day and me tying my hair back and saying, you know, I'll go to battle for you because, you know, you're worth that effort. And we really should apply that to all of our children, no matter what, right? You know, it's like, it's kind of our job as parents, but that somehow by the necessity of fighting for that expectation, that somehow their life wasn't valuable at all. It's like, I don't know. Again, like ignorance. I've not walked it through, like these decision makers, or maybe they would let their child out. I don't know. It's like, but this obviously I'm talking a lot about these things from the perspective of my experience with my daughter, but I've also done a lot of human rights work over the years. That's actually my background is in human rights on the global scale. I've, covered some really intense atrocities. Every corner of the earth is afflicted with them. You know, it's not just a consequence of the West, right? You know, it's just a consequence of human condition. You know, unfortunately, we're capable of doing great good, but great evil also. And I think it's always deeply tied to that translation of human worth being just because you're human, right? If you believe that all people have the same value because they're human, then you're less likely to drive a world in which you hurt others, right? So from that, I founded a nonprofit. It's called Dignity Defense Institute. And we educate on these concepts of human dignity and why it matters to recognize the dignity of all around us. And, you know, I did that totally on my own before the birth of my daughter, but I always say my mission was given flesh and bone the day that I held my daughter and realized like, hey, we're on a different journey. So that's why I probably seem very passionate about this area is because it's not just my child. It's been my career. It's been what I've seen, not just here in our own backyard, but around the globe. And every day I get to wrap my arms around my baby. And it's like, I've wrapped my arms around all the people I've advocated all these years because I didn't really get a chance to hug their neck. I didn't get the chance to hold their hand and tell them that they were important enough for people that they didn't know to stand up in defense of the injustice they were experiencing. But I get to do that with my baby. So
it's kind of like a little bit of every story and every experience that you knew about.
Yeah.
It all wrapped into one little body.
One little tiny body that's so precious and such joy. So
what are you working on now right now?
So I do have a podcast of my own. It's called Pro Dignity, No Doubt. And I bring a lot of different individuals with different experiences and together, and they tell their story just a lot like I just did. The real ambition around that is to make people feel not alone in their struggles. Because I think a lot, again, in the Western world, we have this idea that we can escape pain. And that's our purpose in life is to escape pain. So when we experience pain, we're like our mind is blown and then we feel isolated and alone. And so the podcast is really about telling these various different stories and saying how that we overcome as humans and that we're here and you have people in your corner and to really spread awareness about like even some of the resources that these individuals have like gone through these hard things and now they're advocating in their spaces. Right. So I've been working on that and also, you know, just the nonprofit in general. It's a brand new concept. So I've only been really working in it in the last year or so, in which I want people to understand, you know, these stories have relevance and they're important to be told, and just to advocate for a world in which a culture that understands inherent dignity at its foundation. So, yeah.
We are in the process of actually building a resource page for like YouTube channel. Is your podcast a video podcast or just an audio?
It's just audio now. Although in 2024, we're going to shift over to, I've been recording it visually as well, but to kind of like do a backlog of the work. But
yesterday, there's like 20 different YouTube podcasts, video podcasts, but we also want to do an audio for
Oh,
social.
good.
So pass all that information to me.
Yeah,
I can
sure.
put that on there for you.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much. This is wonderful.
Anything else, Mark?
No, I
I
think
think
so.
this was a really great episode. Again, we've had so many awesome guests.
Yeah, well,
I feel like a broken record sometimes because I always say that, you
well,
know.
but honestly, it's stories like people's life's experience are so intriguing to me. Like anybody that I've ever interviewed to, it's like a window into another world, you know, like when people tell your stories. So I don't think it's disingenuous to say every single one is fantastic because they really are.
Yeah.
I think you might have to update that reference, Crystal, because I don't know the kids didn't know what a broken record is.
Yeah, they don't.
Yeah,
Yeah.
no. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Aging.
So way
Okay.
back in the day, prior to CDs even, though they did look similar, that's how
Of.
we made music, was on these discs. Yeah.
So think of it. Okay. A broken CD. I don't want to sound much.
But even then, the CDs are so irrelevant now too. It's so
What are
funny.
some kids today who don't even were born way after CDs?
Yes, that's the
Yeah.
weird thing is like it's totally like there's a whole generation that only knows digital, which I try to teach my daughter, like my oldest. I've educated her on the past. Like my parents did it too. Like they made me listen to comedians from like the 30s and 40s because like their parents did. And so I make my oldest watch like black and white videos and that kind of stuff, so you could see like the history of technology and its evolution. You know, it's like because it's come a long way in a very short time. So
Yeah.
trying to make sure she's
Yeah.
like aware and not ignorant when she gets into a conversation about what a rotary phone is.
Right.
Or yeah.
It's the same psychology, going back to that, of just the terminology, like using that term, a broken record,
Yeah.
is just as indicative, or just as much the same thing as like the things that were taught to us in the
Yes.
damaging psychology of what we're seeing now, you
Yeah.
know, and the trickle-down effect of those things, you know, it's the same, only that's funny and like a thing we can laugh at, you know, but we're not laughing about the other part, you know.
No. Well, and I say it's funny that we still use a lot of phrases too that are like totally irrelevant to us as well. Like there's a lot of phrases that are built into our language where, you know, they haven't really evolved, but we have no idea where they came from. We just say them on record, like a broken record.
But
the one benefit though that we do have in this technological world that we have the ability to make these changes that we wouldn't have had like 50 to 100 years ago, much
Yes.
less be aware of them.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think it's really interesting. If you look at the history of like the line of communication, a lot of the criticism from I've worked in a, like with a lot of older generation is like younger generations, they don't come out and they don't, you know, see the people they're going to vote for and hear them speak. And I always kind of pointed out, hey, you know, if you did go to a speech, the person was only presenting what they wanted to present. It was only the best information about themselves. We live in an era in which we actually have access to all of their dirty laundry, not just what they want to present. We can actually find the things that are hidden. They're not as hidden anymore. So like technology has really opened a lot of doors that are very good, but with all good things, there always comes bad things too. Like you kind of just gotta take the good with the bad. So technology, you're right. Like we can actually go out and it's also opened up a lot of doors for the disability community to do jobs they were unable to do before. Like even to communicate, like those that are nonverbal, but their brain is like working like a top, you know, like technology is so cool. Like they're coming out with some really neat stuff, you
Yeah.
know.
Sure.
Speaking of that, I read the synopsis of a book which looks interesting about how Alexander Graham Bell, who everyone knows invented the telephone, apparently one of his main drivers for
One
trying to
does
do
not
that.
mark.
What?
Everyone does not know that mark.
Yeah. He was the inventor
But
of the telephone. Now they
one
do.
of his main drivers apparently was he didn't want like ASL was becoming a thing, and he for whatever reason his motivation was to keep that down and repress it
Oh,
and make
wow.
people try and use this use like their use hearing,
Yeah,
right?
okay.
So I don't know.
Oh,
But
interesting.
so that looks interesting.
I didn't know that. I didn't know you meant for the phone to be answered with ahoy instead of hello. So, the more obscure
With
facts,
the what?
right? Ahoy,
What is
oh,
that?
that means like when you would cry out over on
Oh,
sea
like
at the sea.
hello. You know how which
Yeah.
instead of
Oh,
hello?
yeah, instead of hello to say ahoy. Yeah, like
Okay.
ahoy, matey. Like that's what we know it as, but
First
yeah.
bit object, like ahoy. What is ahoy?
It's a greeting of the time that did not stick. So we're all good that we've moved beyond the limitations of the mindset of those that invented it, right? Yeah. My dad's an inventor, so I've always been intrigued by innovation. So yeah, it's kind of cool.
So now I'm curious about that. And if you wanted to use ahoy, was that from the boating era?
Yes, it would have been like a declaration from afar to like say ahoy, you hear me. But honestly, it's funny how these really revolutionary technologies start with one application and they evolve so much. Like
Yeah.
I think the toaster was invented for the bedroom, and it only toasted one side. And they're like, well, now I wake up because I want to have like toast next to my bed, but then you realize the bread's in the kitchen, so it's like things like that where you're like, you weren't thinking the
No,
whole picture.
a bunch of
No,
crumbs next to my pillow. I couldn't do it.
no.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're all glad. Like, I love the original concept. Let's evolve this into something that's like.
I think Crystal, that was probably come up with in the day when people who own the house didn't have to clean up the crumbs. They had people to do that for them. Right?
Or that they didn't have really a kitchen that wasn't in the room with them anyway. If they were poor, they probably wouldn't have had access to it anyway. They just put theirs on their stove. So, it's like
Yeah.
silly things, but yeah.
Yeah,
But
no.
we only have the that insight after time, I guess, when they're inventing all these things, they don't, it's hard to have foresight like 20 years out or
Yeah,
whatever.
exactly. They're
Yeah.
just excited for the concept in the moment. They don't really see the application. Now, there's a lot of people that have invented things way above their time, didn't really stick, and then it comes back around. It's pretty cool to watch how like technology emerges. But educate your kids on like where it came from. It's really not been that
Right.
long. It's wild how fast like things have
Yeah.
evolved and the good applications for the disability community and the ways they can use it and access to the job. And actually, I don't know, this might be a good thing for you guys to know, but at least your audience, that when you get to an adult, like most states actually have disability programs in the state that, and even some of them have technology applications, like how to integrate technology into the workforce that help advance the disability community. I'm just finding out about that, and I just thought that was so intriguing. I was like excited that technology could actually serve well in this community and it really enhance people's lives. So,
And then also, some people are so amazed at the kind of technology advances that came from somebody that was disabled.
yes. It's a day-to-day need that they ha needed met. So they that's actually all the good inventions come from necessity. out of necessity. So,
and then there's
we
so
just
many people that just take for granted that those things exist, you know, and they just go on with their lives and don't even think about why it might exist. And that,
well, we don't have a lot of deep thought in culture these days, so we try not to fault them for that.
We just learned about the invention of the folding wheelchair the other day, how it was invented because some guy wanted to be able to go to a baseball game with his friend, and the standard wheelchair wouldn't be able to get in there, get into his car. So they invented the folding wheelchair.
That is so cool. Well, it makes sense. It makes total sense. Yeah. Well, yeah, like technology is moving fast, and using it in the disability community, I don't think that's a bad thing. It can only help. So,
yeah. And then there are so many things that we deal with today on our laptops or tablets or whatever that were invented specifically for making things accessible. And then now they're just commonplace and they're convenience for other normal people. And they just take it for granted that it's here to be a convenience. But why was it invented that way?
Well, we don't often know our history of really much of anything, let alone, you know, the things we use day to day. So,
well, this was a very good episode. And I so much appreciate all of your wise advice.
I hope it's helpful to parents. I mean,
yeah, definitely. We, as much as we can, we try to widen the who we have, you know, on, and that's the disability community themselves, and then the therapist, vocational,
caregivers,
and then also caregivers, you know, and parents, you know, because they're the ones that are shaping the disability community's minds for the future, and we want them to be in a good place so that when the world does wake up,
Well, and they can be an instrumental part of that, because I know it's a very scary place to be, and it's easy when it's scary to not always want to outwardly advocate for your children, as I'm understanding, like, it's normal for me, but I'm learning more and more that some parents, like, see their children almost like a shameful thing. They don't want anybody to know what they're going through, or like, not shameful at all. Like, I want them to feel empowered and excited to wake up every day with their baby.
Which is ironic, because that just makes it harder for them.
Yeah, and you're talking about psychology. There's so much inner working into the human mind and how it responds to like these traumatic events, right? That, you know, it's easier to shut down than it is to face it. But they realize that over time, it's more detrimental to shut down than it is to face it. And like I said, encouraging people to go through that grieving process, that once you're, and it never, the grieving process never actually ends. Because, like, everybody's life journey is a journey. It's not like a destination you just arrive to one day. But if you allow yourself to walk through that process, you can better find joy, like, with your kid. And wouldn't we want that life where we celebrate our children and we celebrate the life that we were given, even if it's not the one we chose? Because your child's going to have to deal with that their whole life, you know? And if they can't feel seen or important or valuable just as they are, you know, what is their adulthood going to look like if they can't feel that as a child? And, you know, you're right. Like, the parents are the ones that are dictating that. And so, you know, I just have a mission of encouraging them that their children are valuable, you know, to be proud of the gift that you were given in them and not see it so much as a burden, you know. But I really appreciate you guys having me on. You guys are, I can see the light of joy shine through you guys and the work that you do. And it's inspiring for me to like see people standing up and be an advocate and a voice for those in this community, because it speaks life into my own daughter's life and experience too. So
thank you. But you know, I was just about to say the same thing about you. We need more people like you that shine a light on different experiences and the different ways that people have been harmed by that kind of what we talked about, that power and follow the money and stuff like that. You know, people have been so damaged and so hurt and deserve the same, you know, same lifestyle, the same human rights as your neighbor, you know, without all the red tape, you know, just because we're born and we're human, we should have those automatically, you know, without having to fight for it.
When society monetizes, it's bad. So, but thank you again.
Thank you for being here, Nicole.
Bye.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye. Again. Thank you so much.
Thanks.